It's good to see all of you again. I'm surprised. A lot of the same faces I saw this morning. You actually know what you're getting into. That's gluttons for punishment, I suppose. It's very encouraging, actually, to hear the words that you've offered in encouragement. I very much appreciate that. And I'm glad and very excited about the time we're going to spend here this week together. I hope you bring your friends. I hope you'll bring your enemies and anybody that you think would have any benefit at all. And I don't mind having conversations with people that you find frustrating. I just want you to know that. There are some folks in your life that you know they need to hear something. And sometimes they can be frustrating to you and you think, oh, I've just beaten my head against the wall with this over and over again. I'm pretty patient when it comes to people like that. Very skeptical people or people that just want to fuss and fight. I enjoy fussing and fighting with folks. If you want to do that sometime, just invite those folks to come. And if they got an issue with something we're doing or saying, I'd be happy to listen to that and we'll talk about that. And I want you to know too, if you have a question about something or an issue with something that I've said from the pulpit, I want to make sure you tell me about it. Let me know. If I've done something wrong, I want to make it right. I don't want to do anything that messes anybody up or gets anybody off the track from where they need to be. I think it's just terribly important that we do all those things the right way. So, with all of that said, I want you to turn in your Bibles to the book of Luke in chapter 10. And I want to look at a passage that you probably know pretty well. If you've gone to church much in the course of your life, you've probably heard about the Good Samaritan. And we talk a lot about that guy in reference to how a person ought to be a good neighbor. But I really want to focus on some of the lessons that we learn from that about how to save souls. There are a lot of lessons in the course of this text that teach us how it is that we need to think if we're going to be soul savers and the seed scattering that we do and the work that we do as a church trying to win souls for the Lord. And we talk about winning souls sometimes, and I think there have been times in our past that people in the church have been accused of being really good at winning arguments. We weren't really particularly good at winning souls. And we've got to get to the point where we learn how to make that happen. Because that's what we've been called to do. And part of that comes from the mindset that we learn from this story that Jesus tells us about this Samaritan man. How he comes to be a neighbor to somebody that he doesn't even know. That mindset, that idea that you've taken responsibility for people who are not really your responsibility, but you've accepted that, that you've decided, I'm going to be a good neighbor, and I'm going to give them what it is that the Lord has given me. That is the very thing that we're looking for, the attitude that we need to adopt. And so that's what I want to talk about a little bit tonight. So let's turn to Luke 10. Let's read this text again. Luke, the 10th chapter, beginning in verse 25. Behold, a certain lawyer stood up and tested him, saying, Teacher, what shall I do to inherit eternal life? And he said to him, What is written in law? What is your reading of it? So he answered and said, You shall love the Lord your God with all your heart, with all your soul, with all your strength, with all your mind, and your neighbor as yourself. And he said to him, You have answered rightly. Do this, and you will live. But he, wanting to justify himself, said to Jesus, And who is my neighbor? Then Jesus answered and said, A certain man went down from Jerusalem to Jericho, and fell among thieves, who stripped him of his clothing, wounded him, and departed, leaving him half dead. Now by chance a certain priest came down the road, and when he saw him, he passed by on the other side. Likewise a Levite, when he arrived at the place, came and looked, and passed by on the other side. But a certain Samaritan, as he journeyed, came where he was, and when he saw him, he had compassion. So he went to him and bandaged his wounds, pouring on oil and wine, and set him on his own animal, brought him to an inn, and took care of him. On the next day when he departed, he took out 2 denarii, gave them to the innkeeper, and said to him, Take care of him, And whatever more you spend, when I come again, I will repay you. So, which of these three do you think was neighbor to him who fell among thieves? And he said, he who showed mercy on him. Then Jesus said to him, go and do likewise. Now, you've probably heard that story since you were a kid, if you went to church growing up. The story of the Good Samaritan. And if you look at the other texts where some of these ideas are at, in Mark the 12th chapter, in verse 34, he says to this guy, you're not far from the kingdom of God. You know, in other words, you've about got it. But in this text, he tells a story to drive home that point. In Matthew's account, verse 40 of chapter 12, it says, on these two commandments that are mentioned here in this text, to love God with your all, to love your neighbor yourself. On those two commandments hang all the law and prophets. I'm sorry, I said Matthew 12, didn't I? I meant Matthew 22 and verse 40. On these two commandments. And then Jesus in this text in Luke, he illustrates it. So it's really important, obviously, that we're supposed to love our neighbors, right? Are we all agreed on that? This is yes. That's what Grover Stevens used to do. This is yes, and this is no. We know we're supposed to love our neighbors. Now, why? Why am I supposed to love my neighbor? Well, I know. It's so we have pleasant neighborhoods. So that everything is nice and everybody mows their grass. We all get along. We have block parties and celebrate each other's lives. And we're just as close as a family. And we all enjoy each other's kids. And we just have a good week from Sunday all the way through Saturday. We have a few laughs once in a while, maybe an occasional barbecue. We are supposed to be good neighbors so we'll really enjoy this life together. Right? Is that the point of you being a good neighbor? Do you really think that Jesus says, be a good neighbor so that you have good neighborhoods? Safe places to raise your kids and go shopping. We are so egocentric in the point of view that we take about some of the things that Jesus says. We have so many people who are not even living up to the potential of the passage that Jesus tells us, if a man would give all that he has to possess the world, if a man could gain everything that the world contains, but he loses his soul, he's lost it all. He's profited nothing. There's no outcome that's good there. You remember that passage? In the United States of America in 2015, we are settling for the middle class American dream. We're not even asking for the world. We're giving up our souls to be middle class Americans. We see this happening all the time. And so we've got it in our heads, as long as the crime rates are down and the kids are not in jail and they're getting good educations, they're getting pretty good jobs and everything is good with the economy, as long as that's good, good neighbors, right? That's why we want good neighbors. Is that it? My friends, that is not what Jesus is talking about. Have you thought recently what it's like to be lost? Really, the portrayal of the man who's taken by the robbers here is one of the best depictions of what it's like to be lost in all of the Bible. Somebody who is kind of going about minding their own business, who gets waylaid by someone they don't even know, and someone takes away their possessions, their livelihood, someone takes away their clothing, their dignity, someone's taken away their health, their ability just to function nominally in life. That's what the devil's doing every day. He's using the lust of the flesh and the lust of the eyes and the pride of life to waylay people and mug them and beat them up and leave them on the side of the street. It's what Paul tells Timothy, a servant of the Lord is supposed to be patient and gentle and able to teach. Why? In that passage in 2 Timothy, in the second chapter, verse 26, he says so that we could get those people who've been taken captive by the devil, who've been ensnared by him, so that we might teach them something and they come to their senses and escape the snare, the trap, the trick that the devil's played on them. That's us. That's what we do. And so in this picture that's being painted, you and I are the Samaritan, the unlikely hero, the person who has no investment in this stranger, who has no other interest in him except that they're doing the right thing. This guy does something, I don't know why he does it. We have no indication what his religious leanings are. We don't have any idea what his convictions are. But somewhere, whether it was a rabbi or his mama or a favorite uncle or a neighbor, somebody taught this guy, you do what's right, whether anybody else was looking or not. And you do the right thing and you be helpful. That's why you're on this earth. Somebody taught that Samaritan guy that. And that's us. Have you thought about recently what it's like to be lost? I'm coming back to that. Did you think I was going to forget to ask that again? Have you thought about what it's like to grow up in a home where your parents are so self-involved, they don't notice that you started smoking weed with your friends, and before you know it, you've gotten into meth. Before you know it, it's taken over your life. Then they're so infuriated that you're in drugs, they kick you out, and that you end up on the street and you're losing your teeth in the middle 20s. You can't get a job. You've been arrested a few times. Now you can't get a job for real because there are some maybe close to felony drug convictions on you because you've been carrying enough. You had to deal a little bit in order to be able to survive. Maybe you've done things on the street and you sold your body. Maybe you should go home tonight and thank your mom and dad they paid attention and grounded you. Maybe you should go home and call up mom and dad and say, thanks for being rough on me. Thanks for my drug problem. My problem was every time the doors were open to church, my parents drugged me. That's the kind of problem your kids need. Have you thought what it's like to be enticed into drinking when you're a teenager? And while all of your other friends go on those little drinking binges on the weekend, you found that you developed a taste for it, and you kind of needed it in the middle of the day on Wednesday. And so you started drinking by yourself, and you were drinking a whole case of beer all by yourself on Friday afternoon before you went to the party when you were a teenager. And before you know it, you're binge drinking every day, and you're getting drunk before noon just to get back to normal. Have you thought what it's like to be in the grips of something like that? To lose your wife or your husband and your kids and your job and everything else because you love that bottle so much? Have you thought about what that's like recently? See, most of the time what we do is we think, how dare those people waste their lives like that? They just got involved in something and they should have just managed themselves better. Okay, maybe they should have. This guy probably should have taken a nightstick or maybe a gun or a big club. He shouldn't have gotten mugged, but he did. And this is the kind of thinking that the priest and Levite did. You should have known better. This is a dangerous road, you moron. Oh, I'm sure he just stood up and went about his business. I guess I should have known better. I'll do better next time if I don't die in this ditch. And so we just compile the problems that people who've been taken captive by the devil are experiencing because they didn't know better, because they got tricked. You see, that's why it's called a snare of the devil, because he caught them. He busted them not paying attention. He got them when they were young or dumb or ignorant. He got them when they were trying to impress somebody else. He caught them in the lust of the eyes or the lust of the flesh or the pride of life. He caught them. And now he's got them. Have you thought recently what it would be like to live like that? Or what it would be like to grow up in an extremely religious household where you were taught what to do in Sunday school every week and you kept on going, But now you live as an adult in a denomination, teaching false doctrine because that was what was taught to you, and and just going through life thinking that you're doing good for people and you're involved in all kinds of good works, but the reality is God does not approve of you. Have you thought about what it would be like to live like that and then get to heaven and have the experience that Jesus paints in Matthew 7, that when you tell Him what great things you've done for Him. In Your name, Lord, I've cast out demons and I've done many good works in Your name. Have you thought what it would be like to hear what Jesus says to those people? Depart from Me, you worker of lawlessness. I don't know who you are. You see, we're spoiled. We're spoiled with the idea that we are faithful. And we've been faithful for long enough now that we've kind of forgotten what it's like to be lost. And you know whose fault it is that those people are lost? It's their fault, right? Whose fault is that? Is it my fault? Well, I know it's not my fault. I don't know those people. So, of course, it's not my problem. You and I, if we think like that, we just don't need to change our minds. Let me tell you what we need to do. We need to repent. It is specifically our business. It is directly our business. You know, some people say, listen, it's nothing personal. It's just business. Let me tell you tonight, it's nothing business. It is all personal. And these lost people are waiting, whether they know it or not, they're waiting on one person to tell them the truth. They're waiting on one person to do something for them that's never been done. And sometimes we just walk past. You know what James says about that? You know, you say you have faith, but you don't do anything with it. What is that? That's dead faith, isn't it? That's not faith at all, is really his point. And he talks about religion. You see what pure and undefiled religion, you know what pure and undefiled religion does? It does things for the people who can't do for themselves. For orphans and widows, you visit them in their trouble. And you keep yourself unspotted for the world. We really love that unspotted from the world part, because we get pretty good at that. Because we figure out that drinking drugs and promiscuous sex, those things are harmful to your life. And so we figure that out pretty early, and we kind of say, you know what? Unspotted from the world, that's what you can call me. And we forget. Religion, friends, is just a structure within which to exercise faith. It's not anything in and of itself. It is a structure within which you examine the text and your life, and you see how those two things compare. Faith does stuff. Religion does not so much. Faith does things. So when it comes to lost people, we need to think about them. Then we need to think about this Samaritan. He shows mercy. He recognizes the plight. And can I just suggest he understands the potential destiny of that injured man if he, the Samaritan, doesn't do something about it. This man is damaged pretty badly. There's nothing in this text in Luke 10 to suggest to us the Samaritan has any idea that the priest and Levite have been passed. Do you get anything from the text like that? I've read it several times, and I don't think there's any reason for us to think he knows that anybody else has been passed. And I don't think there's anything in the text to indicate to us that he thinks other people might be passing by again. All I can see is that he sees in this situation that this man's in bad shape. And so it begins with seeing. He opens his eyes and he says, this guy is in bad shape. And I don't know if it's a practical common sense issue or if he has some training, but he thinks the guy's in bad enough shape that if he, the Samaritan, doesn't do something about this poor guy, he may die in this ditch. He may die on the side of the road, away from his family, away from hope. Naked, shamed, and injured. Is that the way you'd want to die? Would you like to die alone on the side of a road, stripped of your clothes, suffering from physical injury? Is that the way you'd like to go? If that's the only thing this Samaritan knew, he knew at least that, I wouldn't want to die like that, like some poor, beaten, rabid dog on the side of the road. And so he says, I've got to do something. If it is to be, it is up to me. Isn't that a great little two-letter word sentence? If it is to be, it is up to me. And that's what he says. And he says, I see it. And when I see it, that makes me responsible. That gives me responsibility because I see it. And so here is a question for us tonight on the issue of seeing. Can we talk about good people for a second? Does everybody in here like good people? Yeah. Aren't those the people you want to be your neighbors? Good people? What about the people who wait on you when you go to a restaurant? Don't you want the good people to do that? What about the people who interact with your children, teachers and caregivers? Don't you want those people to be good people? Yeah. Everybody does. Am I wrong? Does anybody here want bad people? Evil people? Mean people? Wrong people? Okay, good people. What we're looking for. So, how do you define good? We'll talk about the people who are in our lives with each other, with Christians. And we'll say things like, well, you know, she's not a member of the church, but she's a good lady. She's good people. Well, he's not a Christian, but he's a good man. Well, no, they're really religious. You know, they go to the Christian church. They believe a lot of things like we do. I know they've got that whole instrument of music thing. They're just really good people. What I'm concerned about is that we are not seeing the truth. The truth is this. Forgive me if I offend you, but I can't see this any other way. The truth is this. Anybody who is not baptized into Christ, as the Bible indicates, anybody who stands outside of Christ in the obedience that the Scriptures teach, that person is not good. They are anything but. Now, I'm not talking about their intentions to you. I'm talking about their status before God. And the problem is, folks, when we see people and we say they're good people, that is the end of it for us. We don't see them as being injured. We don't see them as being captive. We don't see them as being ensnared. We see them as being good people. And why would we mess with that if it's not broke? Don't fix it. Isn't that what we think? And so we say, oh, he's a good guy. Has he obeyed the gospel of Jesus as it's outlined in the New Testament? Well, no. Then why are we calling these people good people? I know what you mean, and I'm not trying to dissuade you from being friends with those people. I'm trying to get us to see they're undone. They're not finished. Their goodness is not complete until God, he's the one who says they're good. Until God calls them good, they're not good. Who is good but God? Who can determine that except God? And so what we've got to do is go back out into our lives from this place tonight. We've got to go back into our lives and look over our Rolodex or our contact list or our neighborhood or our coworkers and reevaluate, is this person a good person? If they're standing outside of Christ, is that going to be the speech I give to God on the day of judgment? Lord, please, you can't send them to hell. They're good people. If God says, depart from me, I never knew you, that, by the very definition, means they're not good. And they need to be good. It is more motivational to me to have frank, uncomfortable conversations with those good people because they've got so many other things going for them. But sometimes we don't because We've already seen them as being good. My question, friends, is who's lost? Who in your life is lost tonight? Who would God say is lost? That'll be the only thing that matters. The second thing the Samaritan does is he thinks. He thinks, what happens if I don't do something? That's the only reason I can come up with why this guy would help him. He thinks, what would happen if I don't? So let me ask you a question. People that you work with who are lost, people that you're in a family with who are lost, people who are in your neighborhood who are lost, or that you go to school with who are lost. How many members of the Lord's church do they know? Where else will the truth about the gospel be coming from if it doesn't come from you? Who else is going to teach them what the truth is about how to be saved? If you don't, who will? If I don't do something, what's going to happen to this person? And sometimes we fall in a trap of getting really comfortable and we say, oh, I've got all kinds of time. You know, I mean, we're going to be neighbors for a long time, and then they have to move. And so we sit in regret. We say, we probably should have started working on them sooner, but now they're moving away. I don't know what's going to happen. We should have tried sooner. We should have tried. Or something happens and they die in a car accident or they get sick. And we stop thinking about what it is that needs to be done. And I think sometimes we just think, someone will. Somebody's going to someday. Eventually they will. What? What about today? What about now? It may take several attempts by several people to bring that person on board with the gospel. And it may be your first introduction that opens the door for somebody else. There's just so much to say about that. Well, finally, it ends up, of course, with the doing. The Samaritan acts. He does something for this guy, and he actually does a lot. And there's an awful lot we can learn from this. Number one, he picks him up. This is no small feat. Have you tried to pick up an adult man recently? Physically pick him up? And I don't mean like a jumbo extra, extra large size like me. I mean like just a regular person, like a regular human. You ever tried to pick him up? Unless you spend some time at the gym, that's kind of a challenge. A full-grown man is no easy thing. He picks him up and puts him on his own animal. As I understand it, that is above your waist probably. No matter what kind of pack animal you have, that's above your waist. He picks this guy up and puts him on his own animal. He's either just a beast of a man, or he struggles and sweats and grunts under the weight of this fella, and he's getting blood on him, and this guy's all messed up. He probably smells bad at this point. Who knows what all is going on? I mean, how long has this guy been out here? He picks him up. You know what this tells us? People have to become your project. And it will be messy. You will be inconvenienced. You've got to pick somebody that you know is lost, and you've got to make them your project. And it may take years. And I don't know how long it's going to take, but you need to start today and say, you know what? I'm in it for the long haul. This person will hear the gospel somehow through the machinations that I will run them through. I will be the person who introduces them to the gospel, or it's going to kill me. And you may not have the funnest time with that. But on the day of judgment, when God says to them, well done, good and faithful servant, don't you hope you're just close enough that they can look over their shoulder and say, thank you. Pick them up. There's got to be somebody that you know in your life who needs for you to make them your project. Number two, he bandages this fellow's wounds. Can I just tell you, this is battlefield triage that's happening here. He's assessing what needs to be done right immediately. I don't see Jesus say, a certain Samaritan physician found this guy. Do you see the word physician or any healthcare? Is he an RN perhaps? You see that in this text? You go back and look it over if I missed it. Do you have to be a genius to help somebody? What this guy really needed was somebody to bandage the wound, stop the bleeding. You don't have to be some kind of thoracic surgeon to know when there's an artery that's bleeding. You put your finger in that wound and slow that bleeding down. It might be the difference between that person living and dying. It may not be the very procedure they need, but it may be just enough to keep them alive until they can get the help that they need. Do you see where this is going? You may not know everything you need to know about the Bible. And so often we make that excuse, well, if I start talking to them, they may ask questions I can't answer. I don't know. Who am I to teach anybody the Bible? I don't think I remember my books of the Old Testament. What am I supposed to say in this environment? I don't know what to do. How do you start? I tell you how you start. Put your hand on the wound and stop the bleeding. Sometimes that has to be enough in the offing. Just to get started, whatever is killing them, you can bandage it. It may be like a Band-Aid on an arterial bleed, but you can bandage it, and every little bit of help is something better than they were getting before. You may just have to intervene. You pour on oil and you pour on wine. This was meant to be medicinal. Again, I don't think this was a first aid kit this guy was carrying around. This is what he had. And there was some medicinal effect that was going to be had here. It was soothing. It would be helpful. I don't know what all needs the person that you're thinking of has, but I do know something. You're holding in your hand all of the oil they need, all of the ointment that they could use. The answer for whatever the problems are right here. And you start directing this book. And friends, I'm going to tell you something. In the next 10 years, what we're going to see is a massively biblically ignorant society searching for answers, searching for some absolute truth. And we're going to see, and I know you might be surprised at this, but the longer I talk in Louisville, the more college students and young adults I talk to, the less and less I'm surprised. They don't know the story of Adam and Eve. They've never heard about Noah's Ark. They don't know who David and Goliath are. They hear these societal references. They've heard about a good Samaritan. They have no idea. It comes from the Bible. I said something to one of the college students a couple years ago. I said, you know, the heart is deceitful above all things. Who can know it? He said, is that Shakespeare? I said, that's Jeremiah. They don't know anything about the Bible. Everything you know about the Bible, even those simple Bible stories that we tell kids, that's medicine. That is medicine for people who don't know anything about it. They've never heard some of this before. And if they've never heard that, do you know they have also never heard? There's a father who loves them. In a fatherless epidemic like our society is going through, one of the precious, most precious messages you can give to anybody who's lost is that they have a father who loves them and misses them and is taking care of them. To find out that your father has always been present when you're a kid who grew up without a dad, that's rich right there. That's medicine. And you can pour it on. Put those people on your own animal. You're going to have to let people lean on you while they figure out their own faith. You're going to have to provide for them out of your own stores. It is sad to think that some people are going to be lost because I just couldn't be bothered. You know, I know they wanted to keep talking across the fence about this religious thing, but my show, we're getting ready to come on. And I hadn't set the DVR to pick it up. And so if I missed it, I was going to have to wait for the rerun. And you know, it goes on. It's episodic. It goes on week after week. It's sort of a continuing story. If I missed that, then I wouldn't know what's going on next week. And I might as well just quit watching for the whole series. Okay. We're talking about someone whose soul is in jeopardy. Put them on your own animal. Take your animal and quit using it for such dumb stuff. Use it for something useful. Have you ever gone to some expense for someone who didn't seem to appreciate it? You ever gone to some trouble for someone who didn't seem to think it was a big deal? You drive away or walk away from that situation and say, man, some people, right? How much thanking the Samaritan do we see this man doing in this text? I don't see that he says anything. Frankly, I don't think he's conscious. And that describes the people we're dealing with. They have no concept of the reality that is God and eternity. This, friends, your life right here in this world, things you can see, touch, taste, feel, hear, that is an illusion. And it is brief at that. The reality is heaven. The reality is hell. The reality is eternity. That's the reality. And there are a lot of people unconscious to that. And so while you're trying to help them, and you go out of your way to help them, sometimes they're not going to think to say, oh, well, thanks. Appreciate your very rich and deep spiritual assistance. They may not think to do that at all. He takes this man to an inn where he can be healed. It's a safe place. If I asked you right now, would you say the Danville Church of Christ is a safe place for sin, sick, and injured people to heal and recover? Do we have any doctors and nurses here, spiritual doctors and nurses, who know how to treat sin, sick, and wounded people? Anybody? Anybody who's going to put their arm around someone and say, honey, we've been there. I know what it's like. You have anybody in this congregation who can go up to someone who's embarrassed because they've never been to church and they don't know how to act and they feel really awkward, uncomfortable? Someone say, you know what? You should come sit with me. I've got a good seat right here. You sit right here with me. Someone who, when they're trying to flip through the Bible because they don't know the books of the Bible, someone will say, here, I've got mine open. Can I have yours? I'll switch with you. A safe place where healing can occur. Where you remind them, everybody in this place was wounded by the same enemy. Everybody in this place would be in bad shape if someone hadn't helped them. And I'm right on the top of the list. Let me help you. Is this a safe place for people like that to recover? Sometimes you have to support the caregiver. You know, I don't know what all business this Samaritan was on or where he had to be or if there was an appointment he had to keep. But I can see this. He had to go do something else. And so what did he do? He left him in the care of this innkeeper. And he said, here's money. I can't be the one to help him right now. You're going to have to help him. But let me support you. And if it comes to pass that it costs you more to take care of this guy than what I've just given you, I will pay you when I come back. You know, sometimes because your schedule, because of your particular lifestyle, you may not be able to do for some people, for lost people, like someone else can. But you know what you can do? You can buy dinner for the person who's teaching somebody the gospel. You can help them by supporting their efforts. You can say, you know what? I heard you're going to have this person over to have a Bible study. Why don't you let me bring you all some sandwich stuff? Or how about, here, you just take this gift card. Y'all run to Cracker Barrel. Y'all go study up there. Here, let me help you do that. Do you have everything you need? Here, I know you're busy. I know you've got all this other kind of stuff going on. I'm going to cut your grass today. I'm already cutting mine and we're just real close down the road. I'm going to take care of some stuff like that so you have everything you need to take care of this. Sometimes that's the kind of help you can give. And you know what part of that you play in the salvation of that soul? The support of the caregiver, the one who's doing the teaching. That, my friends, that's what the Bible calls fellowship. That is the most biblical definition of that there is. That you offer your support to someone who's teaching someone else the gospel. You make it possible for them to have the time and the freedom to do that. Well, that's a good way to do it. Is that not showing up on the screen? there's a word at the bottom that says return. Trust me, it's there. This Samaritan had every intention to come back. He said, I'll come back and pay you if there's anything that you need that you didn't, that I didn't provide for. The most dangerous phase of a Christian's life is the first 6 to 9 months. Oh, those first couple of weeks, man. Everybody's going to set the woods on fire. They're going to convert everybody in their family. They're going to convert everybody in the school. They're going to convert everybody in the county. Just watch out. They're going to turn the city on its ear. They're going to win everybody over for the Lord. Isn't that the way it is when someone's first baptized? Oh, and sometimes they'll bring everybody in their family to church. I told them about it. I told them church. I said, they need to come. So here, Mr. Scott, here's somebody I've been working with. And they said they were going to come. And I told them. And you come up and they'll say, you know, Mike, I've got 12 people coming to church next Sunday. They all said they were coming. And then they don't. And they're discouraged. When someone's won to the gospel, you're going to have to keep returning to them. You're going to have to bolster them and support them and encourage them, because those first few months, the devil will give you 3 to 6 weeks with that person free of charge. He doesn't worry about them. He's like, oh, this business, this spiritual high business, I don't have anything to combat that. I don't have anything to whip that. But I can wait, and I'll wait, and I'll wait. And one day, they'll get discouraged. And when they do, I'm going to be right there. And I'm going to say, wouldn't a drink be good right about now? Oh, why don't you call Alex over here? He has the best weed in the county. Oh, why don't you call Janine? Remember Janine? Remember how nice she was to you? Oh, why don't you? See, the devil will be there, and you've got to keep coming back into those people's lives. And yes, you got to get into their business. You've got to meddle in their lives. I think sometimes the idea that we have of privacy and seclusion is something the devil's using. In the New Testament, it says we're to confess our trespasses to one another and pray for one another. It doesn't say keep all your secrets good and tight so nobody knows that you make mistakes. Sometimes we got to return. Help those people out. Well, Jesus said, which one of these did the right thing? And he said, the one who showed mercy. And what then did Jesus say? Go and do likewise. My friends, that's the conclusion of that lesson. Go and do likewise. Is there something we can do to help you tonight? You may be discouraged about your faith. Maybe you've been walking with the Lord and you have had a hard row to hoe recently, and you're very discouraged, and maybe nobody knows about it. Do you need us to pray for you? Maybe you've fallen off the road. Maybe you've been mugged. Maybe you've been beat up. Do you need us to help you? If we don't know it, we can't help you. Maybe it is you've never obeyed the gospel, and you're intimidated by that. Do you know you'll never be in a more supportive environment than this one right here? Everybody's rooting for you. And the angels of heaven are warming up to sing praises and get excited about your obedience to the gospel. Can we help you with that tonight? If you've never obeyed the Lord, or if you need us to help you in some way, why don't you come right now as we stand and sing?